Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. I'm here live at the scene, or a couple hours after the scene, of a screening of Civil War. John Derringer has seen it quite recently. So welcome, John. What can you tell us?
Thank you, Nick. Well, I'm still a little shell-shocked. I just left the battlefield about 3 hours ago. Yeah, I had a very special screening noon at the Regal Union Square, several weeks after my fellow critics.
Wait, actually,
I don't know if I should say fellow. I feel like that's elevating my position.
No, come on. Well, who was there? I want to know who goes to the noon. I always want, because that's part of what I love, going to the noon screen.
Well, it was funny. Yeah. So this was, you know, again, this is like opening day. Pretty much, I think there may have been like an 11 a.m. or something. But actually, I had a meeting in the morning, and then I found myself by Union Square, and I was like, let me just like pop in and see what's playing. But I was texting a friend who works at A24 and telling them that there was everyone there was wearing camo except me. This is true.
Wait, really?
Yeah. And that this guy, there weren't that many people in the theater because it is like a, you know, like noon Friday screening. This guy was like pacing around me really aggressively in like combat boots. And I was a little scared. I was like, you know, I've always been like very anti, I don't want to live in like a police state, and I feel very, you know, I care about like civil liberties and everything, but I was like, I am actually kind of happy they were like checking backpacks.
Yeah.
This dude was kind of freaking me out. And, and they found my gun. So.
because I mean, camo in a civilian setting is kind of like universal symbol for something bad might happen. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. I was like, I'm going to get, the Dark Knight.
Yeah, that's the one.
And it's just going to be like one repertory film daughter who dies.
Oh, God. Yeah, that would have freaked me out very much. Were they dressed in like sort of like theme, like they were cosplaying the film or something? Or
no, I mean, honestly, it just seemed like a dude who probably wears camo pants every day.
Okay.
Not to say that he's not, doesn't have multiple different pairs of camo pants, but then a few other people sprinkled in, and so not literally. I mean, there were probably, I don't know, 12 people there.
Yeah.
It would have felt, I'll put it this way, if it were at Spectacle, it would have felt like a pretty crowded screening.
Okay.
No, maybe more than, I don't know, give or take. So not everyone there was in camo.
Okay. Well, I guess that's, you know, there has been a lot of anticipation for the movie. So I guess people got excited. But then you sat for the film. You stood your ground.
I did, yeah. I refused to be intimidated. I don't let fear guide any of my choices. I bravely sat through this 2-hour film. Yeah, you know, it was funny too, because I'm curious like what's going to happen with the box office and everything, because I do feel like the people I've talked to who are the most excited about it do tend to be my like right-wing paramilitary friends.
You have a lot of those.
Kidding. Okay, I'm half kidding. No, just like, you know, I'll say like who the fuck is gonna see this movie Civil War? Like, who cares about this movie? And then it's like someone will be like, well, you know, my cousin Dale, you know, he's already got his tickets for opening day and stuff. But then again, maybe there is a general enthusiasm, but people, you know, sort of closer to my typical world are more like being jaded about it. And you know, again, I was definitely like too cool to see it until the last minute. Then I was like, fuck it. sort of
yeah.
Impulsive decision. I was also thinking too, there's one line in the film, not to jump too far ahead of ourselves, where they reference the, what is it called? The Antifa Wars?
Yes, the Antifa Massacre. Someone's
written. Yeah, the Antifa Massacre. And I was like, had I known that was a line in the film, I would not have seen it.
Yeah. I found that was kind of a low point. Also, because like that's how it always is in dystopias. They're like, nothing's been the same since like the, I don't know, like the they come up with some word like the since the explosion of so and so or something like
The synthetic uprising.
Yeah, that's right. since the aluminum uprising. But we never say that. We always just say like Charlottesville or January 6th. It's always much more boring than that. It's never like Antifa massacre.
Yeah, they could have just said like that's kind of what John Carpenter does kind of well, where they're just like, you know, and like Escape from LA, which, you know, I really love, even though like some people don't think so much of that one, where they talk about like Cleveland, you know, and they're like, you don't know, they're talking about, you know, back in Cleveland or everything that went down. And it's like, they don't specify it because that is how you would talk, like you're just saying about that kind of thing where it's like, you know.
Yeah.
They're not like, oh, ever since the, you know, presidential, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah. Whatever, well, it's like the talking heads, like life during wartime, you know, it's like, heard about Pittsburgh, PA, you know, it's just for people just tuning in now, although that's kind of impossible, but we're talking about Civil War. If you haven't heard about it, it's about this in the future at some point. Do we get a year? I'm not sure we do, but.
I don't think you do. It's not really clear, I guess, but I guess not too distant future.
Yeah, where the country has broken apart into, I don't know, at least three parts, probably more. And we're kind of with these journalists who we meet.
I think it starts in New York.
Yeah, it does start in New York. Yeah.
And it really doesn't look like New York.
No.
Like when I saw the NYPD cop car, I was like, what?
I mean, that's one of my problems with the movie, is that a lot of things just I wasn't buying.
Yeah.
But yeah, it starts in New York and you kind of get together this band of journalists led by a Kristen Dunst character who's the veteran journalist opposite Kaylee Spaney.
I didn't recognize her. I just saw Priscilla. I was like, that's the same person.
It's a crossover universe thing. Yeah.
She somehow looks shorter in Priscilla and yet younger in this movie.
I think that's true, yeah. I mean, when it started out, I actually thought there's no way this character is going to continue in this movie because she looks like a, you know, almost like a high school photography student.
Yeah.
This must be just kind of a setup. But yeah, she joins, I don't know, four people, I guess, total who are going to DC.
So including her, it's like a quartet of journalists, war correspondents.
Yeah. The other one being Wagner Moura, and an actor of that, I don't know, I feel like most people are always kind of happy to see, even though he often gets these roles that feel kind of thankless, Stephen McKinley Henderson, who plays a New York Times journalist.
Yeah.
So they're all on this trip to DC where they want to, well, the Kirsten Dunst character wants to interview the president.
Yeah. Who among us?
That's right.
Get Joe Biden on the Last Thing I Saw podcast.
Yes, it will happen one of these days when they're extremely desperate for coverage, I don't know, late August. So yeah, I mean, that's the outlines of it. I have to say, like, am I the only one? I feel like I'm the only one who watched a lot of these, but like these war journalist movies.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of, is it Salvador?
Yes.
The Oliver Stone film. Is that James Woods stars in it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Trying to think, what are other good, I mean, like Medium Cool is obviously, I mean, that's more of like a film rather than just like straight up photojournalist thing. But
yeah, I ran into that too when I was trying to come up with specifics, but Salvador is definitely one of them, which I did actually rewatch a couple of years ago. And I do have to kind of give it props for, like, I mean, it's so graphic in like the atrocities that it's showing. But I guess it is maybe an 80s thing. Like there's also, isn't Year of Living Dangerously sort of this, like expat journalists at least?
I've never seen it.
And then there's Under Fire, where Nick Nolte plays a journalist.
Oh, wow, yeah. It's definitely more of a journalism film. The only thing I knew about it is that it was called Civil War and that the title is in this hideous green.
Yeah.
That's pretty much, I mean, and I knew, you know, the basic cast and stuff, but like, I generally don't know a lot of shit, so I didn't realize it was about like journalists.
I didn't either. Like I had kind of kept away from learning anything, and I didn't know that either. And then I read a tiny bit because I was reading, like, you know, I was reading a Kirsten Dunst interview, or, you know, I mean, because she's pretty unfiltered, so that's always fun.
Yeah,
but didn't really realize that. And Yeah, the Civil War, it's like Hulu green. That's what it is, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, or like I would say almost like a chroma key. Like, okay. it almost in a weird way. I mean, I'm trying to think like what were even the conversations around it, or like how did they come up with like this color of green? Because in a way to me that color represents invisibility, because it is a color that's meant to be replaced, you know, something else,
right?
Not to be too like conceptual about it, but I feel like that was kind of a thing a while ago in like contemporary visual art with like Hito Sterile or Sandra Perry, where it's like using, and I think Sandra Perry does it really well. I'm not as much of a fan of Hito Sterile, but it's like, you know, green representing kind of like invisibility, or it also represents, you know, special effects.
Yeah, green screen, green, yeah.
So I don't know, I was like, is this like some conceptual thing? Is this also a meta commentary on the politics of the film, which are also arguably somewhat invisible? Or like, I don't know, or projecting kind of whatever you want onto it. But also, it's like, I don't know if people are that smart. I don't know. Now I sound like an asshole, but.
No, but what you're saying, that really makes sense, because I think it does kind of just work on you a little bit in a way, because it's not like, what were they going to do it in like a gothic or something, you know, or anything else that gives it. I mean, there's a sort of a sidestep in the choice of that typeface, which is kind of what I felt about the movie generally, although maybe not in a positive way.
Yeah. It's also, I feel like marketing, it's like you need a new color every now and then, and people are always trying to find the new. So like for a long time, you know, everyone in media was talking about screen slate purple and how like that was the trendy, you know, Gen Z loves screen slate purple. But now, I don't know, but now it's going to be Civil War green.
Civil War green.
They're coming after. No.
They're going to own green.
Yeah. Out of my cold, dead hands.
I'm having flashbacks to when orange was like a trendy color in the 2000s, mm-hmm. Briefly.
Yeah. Well, if the movie does well, we'll probably see, you know, the next like Captain America Civil War movie.
Right. Yeah. Some people were pointing out that the Captain America Civil War.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, what did you make of this movie?
So this is the thing, is like, I hate to say it, but I liked it, despite my many drags on it. I mean, to me, like watching it, it just felt pretty evidently like, you know, like Alex Garland, I don't really like the films he's directed. I think I've seen Ex Machina. I don't think I've managed to stay awake through Annihilation or Men is especially, I'm like, I've tried to watch the first 5 minutes of that like 20 times.
Yeah, I'm like that with Saltburn.
Yeah, and I'm just like, this isn't like, fuck this. But, you know, I was really into 28 Days Later when that came out as kind of like a reinvention of the zombie film, which was, you know, part of that whole wave with like Land of the Dead and the Dawn of the Dead remake and, you know, Dread I really liked, which he wrote. So I've enjoyed some of the films that he's written. And to me, this felt like a lot like revisiting 28 Days Later, and sort of just like a zombie film without zombies. I also think some of those films, especially Dread, have a lot to do with video games. And again, I this isn't a filmmaker I care for, so I've never read interviews with him. Like, I don't know if he's talked about video games or acknowledged them as an influence. But the politics of it, or sort of lack thereof, reminded me a lot of the way politics are handled in video games. And there's one in particular called The Division, which is like a hugely, hugely popular game. And there's a sequel. It's been a couple years now that these games have been out. And they're about sort of like this virus that kind of decimates the country and then turns the country into a civil war. So the virus isn't infecting people in like a rage zombie way. It's kind of just like the pretext of, you know, why they're so anyway, blah, blah, blah. But it's like these video games are so obviously political in nature, especially The Division 2 is set in Washington, D.C. So it's like you know, it's a, it is like a civil war where it's like you've got the like rioters and there are these kind of Antifa stand-in people and you're this sort of like paramilitary force or something that's trying to restore balance.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you are literally like fighting in the Capitol building and stuff. And then the, you know, the game designers are like, well, it's not political. You know, we're not trying to make like a political statement. And especially with that one, I think probably came out around like 2017 or something, you know, when people were already thinking about the Trump era. So, I mean, to me, this was just like literally, I was like, this is literally like 28 days later without zombies, structurally in terms of the characters and their relationships, the way that it's kind of like a road movie, but also like that sort of plausible deniability of being political while being in a obviously a super politically charged context, which I think is really familiar to video games. And The Division isn't the only example of that. I think it's just the most relevant one and one of the most glaring ones, you know, where you're trying to make like mass entertainment about these themes that are fraught with obviously guns and violence, which has a political connotation, and then directly relating to, you know, law, order, society, and then like literally the US government itself, you know, trying to like avoid, you know, any kind of like left-right reading. And I think in a way, like, I feel like my reaction to that would typically be like, that's so cowardly, that's so cynical, that's, you know, such bullshit. But I don't know, like for some reason, it did sort of like click for me in a way where, you know, I think Alex Garland from stuff he was saying in interviews about how like the film's not political or whatever. I mean, he sounds like an idiot. And I mean, he is still, when I think back on that, an idiot. But I think he is trying to do something where it is more almost in like Manolo said in her New York Times review, I mean, it's like speculative fiction. And, you know, obviously it, just the idea of a civil war that hasn't actually happened yet, or I mean, a modern, you know, civil war is inherently speculative. But I think there's something about the film that is meant to be more abstract, and it's more, I think it really does, to get back to the zombie thing, I guess, just kind of feel like sort of a horror film in some ways. So
yeah,
that was what I ended up responding to kind of unexpectedly, because the politics makes, they so obviously make so little sense that, you know, the, as everyone has rightfully pointed out, like the California Texas alliance,
right?
We're like, what? And it's like, I almost feel like maybe I'm giving too much of a benefit of a doubt, but it's like so dumb,
yeah,
that, and implausible, that it kind of signifies to you that you're not supposed to take this seriously, and you're not supposed to read it as like a literal commentary of like, you know, a more realistic approach. Like, if you think of something like, I mean, I'm sort of pulling a movie somewhat at random, but like War Game by Peter Watkins, where it's like, this is like what it would actually be like if this scenario were to occur, or something like Threads, which, you know, it's taking a speculative thing and sort of trying to make a more, I don't know, like, I guess you could say like realistic or plausible version of that. And this film to me just didn't seem like it was concerned with being like a plausible, purely, I don't know, like literal or direct interpretation of like an American Civil War. It, to me, it just felt like, again, to return to the zombie film, it's like, because the country is so screwed up and has been so screwed up that we've been in this zombie film cycle for like 20 years now, you know, it's like we've become obsessed and fixated on these images of the country crumbling, and of division among people. Because that's the other thing about the zombie film, is like, you know, the sort of cliche is like, the zombies aren't the real monsters, it's the humans, you know. And so to me, this just felt like a further extension of that, where it's like, well, then let's just like take the zombies out of it. And this is just a film about, in a lot of ways, just like inhumanity and horror,
yeah,
you know. And so those are kind of the levels that I really responded to it on. And
yeah,
I mean, again, I feel like maybe I'm hitting the same note over and over, but thinking of like those early scenes in the original Romero, Dawn of the Dead, you know, kind of where they're like trying to refuel the helicopter and stuff like that, when they're kind of more on like the journey before they get to the shopping mall. It's right. Like kind of, that's kind of like the register that this film is in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting what you're saying. Like, it does like tally with what my experience was, that it felt like a movie about an idea or about like a mood, but it was choosing this, you know, scenario that felt like it had to be so specific. So, I mean, that became the kind of trap of with the movie, which is that, like, why would you choose something where, you know, anyone could look at it and say, well, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't feel real. But I mean, the more I thought about the war journalism angle, it felt like maybe that's less of a sidestep, and maybe that's just a, like a device to have you look at this situation from a kind of askew look. I mean, I didn't love how the movie is, it has this thing it sets up with Kristen Dunst being like the veteran journalist, then Kaylee Spaney's the like younger, the Tyro, who's really naive. That relationship, like, I didn't buy a second of that, you know. I mean, Dunst is like great, like she just is like sort of riveting, but after a while even she kind of peters out with what can be done. What I will say is, thinking about the idea, that idea of being somewhat removed from what's happening, that could get interesting.
Yeah.
But then I also felt like, or does that get kind of trolly ultimately? Because like, it's not exactly both sidesism that's happening here, but it is just kind of like a vagueness in the name of drama. The movie, it would come into focus with certain scenes that are really like,
yeah,
interesting. You know, like they go to one town where everyone is just laying low and yeah, business as usual, which is like a great piece of like satire, I would say, basically, because it probably in a way describes a lot of us, you know, as a kind of coping mechanism of just like acting like nothing's happening just to continue. So that felt really vivid, but then there would be stuff in between where I was like, what? I'm not buying these like old buddies they run into. And because of that kind of loss of faith, when they have a scene like with like a mass grave, at that point I'm like, yeah, didn't really get there. Sorry, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I totally hear what you're saying, and it's strange because somehow some of those things just kind of worked for me, and they shouldn't. Like, I'm having a difficult time, maybe even articulating or like defending them, and you know, this isn't, you know, a hill I would die on or anything, but. You know, some of those things with like mass graves, it's like these images of horror. And I think it's just the movie, it just kind of is overwhelming you with these scenes of horror that you kind of have to construct your own stories and impressions around. You know, yeah, like the Jesse Plemons mass grave scene. It's like you have no idea who those people are or like what the context is. Even the whole story, you know, kind of around his character and the other guy he's with, it doesn't really give you a lot, but I think it gives you enough to be like very disturbed. I don't know. Something about that worked for me. But again, I wouldn't, I mean, I think too, to return to the journalists, I do think a potential, like something I feel like I should hate about the movie is that my assumption is that, you know, if you want to make a film about a civil war, it's like, I guess you would have to take a side typically, right? And then, well, what if we do a journalist? Because journalists are objective and there is no side when you're a journalist. And so it kind of is playing into and depending on this, I think, basically myth that journalism is like a purely objective occupation.
And I mean, and that's why it kind of probably gets under the skin a little bit, is because that's exactly what people are so frustrated with. People were making fun of a recent news headline of like, there are two imperfect ambassadors for abortion.
Yeah, yeah.
It's stuff like that where it's like, I don't know. So I don't know. I mean, if that's what happens, maybe it does work that the movie has this, I don't know, ideological fogginess to it or something.
Yeah. Well, it's also for a film about journalists, you don't see the fruits of journalism like anywhere in the movie. Like, you never see anyone reading a newspaper or looking at an article on their phone, or I think maybe there's a TV broadcast at some point. But yeah, again, it's like, I think they mention almost in passing, right, that the guy writes for the New York Times or something. But it's like, well, what are the role of these publications in this society? Like, sort of where did they stand? Because obviously there are ideological alignments with publications and with journalism.
Yeah, definitely.
And then, oh, and then they say they work for Reuters, which again, I feel like Reuters is kind of one of the like old school objective, you know, professional, but I don't know, but that's
also what bugged me is that the movie treated them like they were expats in a foreign country, you know, another country that we don't know nothing about, and so they're kind of isolated, but they're not. Like, the movie felt depopulated. That's where it just felt like there was always something missing. Like, the most we see of people was like at the beginning and the end, like people, you know, and yeah. And that was kind of weird for me too, to kind of ride that, you know, thrill of having a civil war without really having a sense of other people, you know.
Yeah.
They're just these kind of, you know, I constantly had the feeling like this is like the part in the Western where they come across the like ghost town.
But I guess like what you're saying about the film feeling depopulated, and maybe I'm giving too generous a reading of the film, but I feel like it was supposed to feel a little uncanny. I don't feel that the film was totally meant to be set in like reality. And in that way, again, this is where this is maybe, again, way too generous and too far of a reach and maybe kind of pretentious or something. But like, you know, it almost reminded me of something like Stalker, where it's like, it's a landscape that looks familiar and looks sort of normal enough, but it's just full of like danger, you know?
Yeah.
Seen danger at every corner. And I think that's kind of what ties it in with Annihilation as well, which again, I can't even remember if I've seen all the way through. It was obviously a movie that's like trying really hard to be Stalker in like a over the top way. And this is almost like kind of a different, but you know, yeah, just that idea of like traversing a hostile landscape, which I think 28 Days Later also does really well.
Yeah, no, I like that. Yeah, I like that idea that, yeah, I mean, maybe it's too literal minded to kind of expect it to be fleshed out more. I mean, that does kind of go with another feeling I had about the movie, which is, and maybe this goes back to him being kind of, I guess, initially primarily a screenwriter, you know, which is that it felt kind of writerly, you know, it felt like a novel, like if this was a novel, maybe I wouldn't question some of the things I'm talking about, you know, because
yeah,
it would just be like 30 pages of like Kirsten Dunst, like monologuing to herself or something, you know?
Yeah. But also like, speaking of that, I mean, I do like, you know, again, like not to totally play into the whole thing of like A24 is the author of every A24 movie, but like, I think a lot of films they release don't have strong screenplays, and it was nice to see a film that, whether the screenplay was great or not, there was something that felt like, yeah, like writerly about it. Like someone who's like read, I don't know, like a Sid Field book or like Robert McKee or whatever, and is just, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like as heavy as it is on like vibes, I felt like it was like a screenplay first, vibe second film, whereas, you know, other films that I feel like kind of A24 gravitates toward are like very vibe heavy, and the sort of story structures and even individual scenes like don't really cohere. But again, now I'm like, what if I feel like a sellout, where I'm like, you know, everyone should have three act structure, everyone should, you know, everyone needs to be motivated, every you know, beat needs to be there, but yeah, I just felt like the character relationships were mapped out in a legible way. Every scene kind of had like a beginning, middle, and end, and a point to it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I feel what you're saying in the sense that like, maybe that's what I'm feeling when like scenes would kind of click into place. Like when they were in a scene that was written and had like a structure to it, that worked. But the way it all tied together, and then it definitely like just hit a groove with the final act. It almost felt to me like, was part of this movie just kind of a pretext to have this final act to a certain extent, which I actually would love to talk about if you're open to it.
Interesting. Yeah. In some ways, the final act was like my least favorite.
Oh, I don't mean that I liked it. I just mean that it had a purpose to it. Like, and so, and purposefulness to it? I don't know.
At a certain point, I was kind of wondering, I mean, to speak of like, you know, kind of screenwriting rules or cliches or whatever, I'm kind of like, what's the goal here? Like, what are we pointing toward? What are we headed toward? You know, to interview the president? I'm like, that's not actually that interesting of a, they're risking their lives to interview the president? Like, who gives a shit? That actually, to me, felt a little like flat. But then it's like, oh, of course we're going to end up in the White House. Like, you can't have a movie called Civil War that's kind of like on this linear trajectory pointing toward DC that does not end with confronting the president in the White House. And again, that also felt very like video gamey to me, where it's just like the president, you know, like
final boss
and these like 80s Nintendo games, you know, where it's like, you know, gotta save the president, you know, like the second most cliche thing being like, the president's daughter has been kidnapped, you know?
Right.
Like, there's that meme where it's like, what game? I think it's like the game Bad Dudes, where it's like, are you a bad enough dude to save the president? You know? And it's like, that is who the president is in this movie. He's like, he's just like the president.
Yeah.
But I feel like, again, I think Alex Garland is kind of stupid, but surely he must be like smart enough to realize that I want to give him the benefit of the doubt that that's a little kind of like intentional, maybe sort of even postmodern kind of move or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there was something, I think I feel like people were called Annihilation sort of postmodern in a way. It is hard to tell how much of that is intent and how much of it is accidental somehow in terms of when he tries to realize what he's writing.
Right.
Is he bumping up against the limit and then something interesting happens because of that? I don't know.
Yeah. And then I guess the third option would be that it's pure cynicism in terms of making the film marketable. Like, we don't want to offend people's political sensibilities. But it didn't, I think that's more what I was expecting and was pleasantly surprised to not feel, is that I didn't feel that it's avoidance of politics to me. It didn't feel like a cynical, deliberate move for like broad appeal, you know, because like I just, again, maybe I'm wrong or people could disagree with that.
Well, it did bring out the camo crowd.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the thing. I mean, yeah, like A24 getting a new audience. y'all get to watch the I Saw the TV Glow trailer before it. That was the thing. I was looking back at the camo dude just to see like kind of what he thought, but I didn't really.
If he was loading.
His reaction. He did leave immediately at the credits. Like, and I do think the film does ultimately toe a little bit more of like, I would say, a liberal line. That's the thing, is like, I don't want to say the film is like centrist and neoliberal, because I don't think it is a film that is ultimately arguing for some kind of like, oh, why don't we all just get along, you know, or like trying to establish some kind of like neoliberal order. Like, it didn't seem like a film that did have much faith in people's ability to sort of like reconcile. But there were kind of hints that like the US government seems to be like the more evil one than the California-Texas alliance, just in the sense that like we see the California-Texas alliance as being much more like racially diverse. We don't really see anyone who's in that group doing anything that is especially morally egregious, not to say that we don't see any violence and whatever, but like, whereas the people in the government fatigues are the ones, you know, doing racist murders. And you know when they talk about, oh, the third term and stuff, that feels a little bit like Trump, you know.
Yeah.
So I do feel like there's a little bit of implicating like, a, the US government forces are kind of more the bad guys, and b, they are kind of more Trumpian. But at the same time, I think the film definitely fetishizes militarism and guns. And I mean, I saw it in RPX. And I will say, like, the particular auditorium I was in at Union Square was like my favorite one there. It has like great sound. And I felt like the sound of the gunshots was very, very precise and like particular. It clearly, like, whoever was doing the sound for the film, and you know, I assume under the direction of Alex Garland, was going for an extremely realistic, almost like fetishistic level there. So it's, yeah, it's not like it's not like a liberal film, but I wouldn't also call it like purely reactionary. I don't know.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, but just on the gunshots, actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because that I went at the screening I went to, which was shown in IMAX, which at the moment felt like sort of an insecure choice. Just like, we'll just make it big and then hopefully it'll have a bigger impact.
Yeah.
But there was, I didn't know this when I signed up, RSVP'd to it, but there was a Q&A afterwards with the director and the cast.
Well, Garland was there.
Yeah, he was there. He gave this like almost kind of parodically British self-deprecating opening where he's like, they told me to be upbeat. The A24 guy told me to be upbeat. So this is that. But afterwards, they were talking about the gunshots. And I think Kirsten Dunst was like, yeah, like it really gets in your bones, because they were using blanks, but they made some distinction between like when they're doing gunshots that are like just not really making noise in on the spot, but that they were actually hearing all of that on the spot. So definitely there was something going on with the gunshot audio.
It's like I didn't even have access to the press screening or the press notes, and I identified this.
You
in
did.
Fact, you know what? I hated this movie. They should have to. They have to pay me for this. They have to send me. I want a fruit basket. I want like one of those little green army men modeled after me.
Yeah, it's there were some people who like really jumped up right as it was done and left. That was happening. I mean. Yeah, the politics of it. Yeah, I mean, Nick Offerman's playing president, who's like, there's an aspect of Trumpiness to his like situation, but not necessarily to his manner, except in his kind of boastfulness, I guess. But can we just talk about the ending? I just the sense that, yeah, if you don't want to hear this, don't listen for the next few seconds. But as you said, it all kind of builds up to this ending, which is this huge firefight, this like tank, whatever, you know, military vehicles in the Capitol, and then this like hunt the president down like a rat in the White House sort of scenario. And the president does get killed.
I mean, that is literally the ending of the, I mean.
I never do this, so I'm kind of like.
I don't care about spoilers, so I'm not, you know, I'm not.
But the reason I bring it up is because that was interesting to me that they did that in the movie, because in a way it was to the credit of the movie, because if you're trying to like slip by a Civil War movie without actually fully committing to the politics of it, that's still a sort of inflammatory thing to do.
But it's like, I think this is what is kind of genius about that, is like, no matter what side of, you know, what side of the aisle you're on in contemporary politics, I'm talking about like real world politics, not like in the world of the film. Mm. Like if you're like, you know, right wing, if you're an anarchist, if you're like, I don't know, repertory movie Showtime blogger, if you're, you know, whatever. I think we can all agree, like, it would be so sick if the president died. Like, and like, I don't care who the president is. I just, again, I mean this in the generic term that like the movie's like the president.
Well, that's what got to me about this ending though, because I guess, am I the only one who still gets kind of shocked by that when it happens on screen? Do you remember this movie called Death of a President?
wait, hold on. Everyone can hear my squeaky keyboard.
Yeah, just.
Oh, of course I do.
Remember this, and it was desperately, desperately trying to become a thing, because it had this pretty Bush-like president. I mean, it was, I don't know, trying to be some like cut rate Peter Watkins sort of like, you know, docudrama, but how that would play out.
Yeah.
And it just fizzled and went nowhere. But there was also like Assassination of Richard Nixon with Sean Penn.
Oh, yeah.
And I just remember these movies like being either like just tactfully ignored or, you know, mined for like outrage pieces or something. But maybe people just don't care. I don't know.
But I think it's just, I think that kind of speaks to what I think is sort of interesting about this film or works about the politics. It's like, yeah, I guess a side in the movie wins, but we don't really know what that side stands for, and it's just like, yeah, the president's dead.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's just like, I guess that's kind of what I thought this was building to, and it happened, and awesome.
And now what?
You know, because like some of these you know, it's like George Bush, you know, I think obviously one of the worst people in history, But it's like, I don't know. I don't really care about watching a film about George Bush dying, but something about just like the generic movie president dying, I think is wonderful.
For what it's worth, there was a couple of, I think they were not film critics. When that happened, the woman next to me did the little thing of clapping your hands. It, like when you've just been served chocolate cake and you're really happy.
That's how I felt.
I mean, there is something cathartic about it, I guess I would say, in the sense that it is a highly specific, undeniable act that is happening at that point. It's not just, yeah, kind of coasting around. Because, yeah, there's so, yeah, there is just something really curious going on. Because also, what happens in that final act while I'm annoying everyone is you have the kind of passing the torch from the older journalist to the younger journalist, which feels like is the foreground of drama. But meanwhile, like, this huge stuff is happening in the background. So is the point of this that we're also absorbed in our own like professional and personal dramas, that stuff, the big stuff is just going on and we're all too busy and overworked to think about it? Or maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, I feel like the movie just has this weird, like, sci-fi almost kind of. Again, like, there's ostensibly, it's again, it's like if you took a zombie movie with the rage virus, but then took the idea of the rage virus out, you know, or any reference to it, but that's kind of what it's like. It's just like everyone has kind of gone crazy, everything has fallen apart, infrastructure has collapsed. And you don't know who you can trust, and you're navigating through this horrific landscape. That's kind of, I think, what the movie was basically doing. And on that level, I thought it was pretty effective. But yeah, I mean, like, it makes no sense. And again, I think Alex Garland is dumb. Like, I'm not.
Let us be clear.
Let me be 100% clear. Because the thing is, it's like like nothing is truly apolitical, you know? I mean, not to be not now. I probably sound dumb. Like I'm an undergrad. Like I just figured this out. But yeah, obviously, like it's politically loaded. But again, this kind of gets back to the like video gameness of it, where it's like, okay, we need to sell a game where you're just shooting tons of people, and wouldn't it be cool if you're running around like post-apocalyptic Washington, D.C. But oh, we have to take politics out of it because we don't want to offend any potential. And certainly in video games, it is like a very deliberate, I think, cynical, business calculated decision to do that. But I feel like in a way, it's like this film is taking that, but like doing something with it and doing something more, like making a deliberate choice to do that. I don't know. Somehow I didn't hate it. Another thing too, like kind of to that point is, I saw something which I think was kind of an interesting idea to consider, which I think is sort of valid, is that this movie portrays the United States the way a lot of American films portray, you know, like third world countries, or, you know, like if you think of like the 80s action movie where they're like going to South America and they're shooting like the rebels or whatever.
Isn't it in Top Gun where they never actually name the country that it's
Yeah,
in?
exactly. Yeah, like Top Gun and Top Gun, the recent one, they're just like the enemy. And I can see that, although I would say that a lot of these 80s action movies, like canon films, I think actually do have like very specific concrete politics. You know, like Invasion USA, I mean, they name the country, they name the enemy, you know, communism, communists or drug smuggler, you know, or like Delta Force with Chuck Norris is very very like anti-Arab, like pro-Zionist film, very right wing. You know, it's like I think the people on the airplane are like flying to Israel to like move to Israel or something. You know, it's like it's the politics are very concrete and like a lot of these kind of cheesy 80s action, which I mean, I still love them. I mean, I think Delta Force is a little overlong, and I certainly do not agree with its politics. But yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. It's funny talking about 80s. Like, I've been thinking about like 80s TV shows and action shows, like what the politics were in those as well. Like, for some reason that I keep coming back to like the A Team and like what the hell was the A Team and what were the things they were solving, you know? Like what I kind of want to go back and like make a list of like what were they doing? Like, I wonder how they handled the political apolitical stuff in there. I don't know why I just thought of that, but
Yeah, but
it's the
sometimes it's like it's weird, like they were, I think, a lot more politically specific than Civil War is, but somehow they read as like, it read as like mainstream. So it read as apolitical, even though it was, you know, naming again, like specific countries or naming, you know, communism or, I just feel like maybe there used to be more of like a consensus or in the mainstream entertainment acceptance of just like, whoever the president says America's enemies are America's enemies. And if we put that in a TV show or a movie, it just reads as sort of like, of course, these are like the default enemy or something. And I think it's like, there's a mix now of like, I think there is like a lot more like division now and awareness of this. And yeah, I think there's more like sensitivity and awareness of that. And then also too, like the way the markets for film have opened up where it's like, can't be like the bad guy is China if you have to sell films in China or, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think like globalization in the entertainment industry has meant that like they have to be more nebulous about this stuff. And so again, like, I don't know, like maybe that, I don't know, who can say what Garland is doing?
Yeah.
Our greatest filmmaker, Garland.
We refer to him just as Garland.
Yeah, yeah. Master filmmaker Garland. I mean, I do think his best movie that he's written is like Dread. I don't know if you've seen Dread or a fan. I mean, I love that film.
I know I've seen it. I don't remember much about it. I would like to see that again, definitely.
I mean, it's definitely, I mean, politically insane. You know, it's just like, you're like, I mean, I think you just want to give it the benefit of the doubt that they're like, it's meant to be like a parody or a satire, but it's not totally clear. I mean, obviously it's like propaganda, but so I think we have to look at Civil War as a piece with the Garland oeuvre. And,
sure, yeah.
Really reach back to early Garland.
Well, I mean, generally he it's like he writes screenplays a bit like he's like a feature magazine writer to a certain extent, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, like get something zeitgeisty and that sort of gets under your skin. And maybe just as you're kind of wondering whether it's really making sense or whether there's enough there, then just that's when you switch things off. I don't know.
Yeah.
For some reason, I'm flashing back onto the In the Beach. Isn't there a moment where I don't even know why Leonardo DiCaprio is like a video game character running?
Oh yeah, this makes the whole video game Garland thesis. Maybe I should write a book on Alex Garland and video games. Maybe that's my calling.
Yeah.
I'm a real Garland head now.
You've been Garland pilled.
Yeah.
Well, there's one other thing though I do want to ask about, because yeah, I think you wrote something really funny about it, which we haven't talked about, which is a very creative use of the soundtrack.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, the soundtrack is yet another thing about the film that makes no sense.
Yeah.
So for some reason we open with the Silver Apples, you know, sort of like semi-experimental synthy band from the I think 70s. I think they were kind of like obscure for a while, but then made their way into Nike commercials and stuff. And then like the rest of the music, the needle drops are like the band Suicide.
Yeah.
Barely makes any sense on like any level, like conceptual, vibe wise, time. I don't know. I mean, and it's like, I love the songs and they don't necessarily not work, but they're very foregrounded. It's not like, you know, they're walking by the gas station and the old timey radio is playing Suicide in the background. It's like blasting in your face audio.
It's so weird.
Yeah, including, I mean, as long as we're spoiling the ending, you know, they basically just like shoot the president, and then it's like Suicide's Dreams comes on, and it's like Dreams, and you're like, what?
it's so,
but, you know, again, maybe that's Garland leaving us clues. Dreams. This whole film has been a fever dream.
That's it. You've broken it wide open. That's it. That's what's going on. It felt to me like, did we just suddenly get like switched on to Garland's playlist while he was writing or something? Like it didn't.
Well, no, that's 100%. Like immediately when the Silver Apples thing started, or no, I think it was probably when the first Suicide Needle Drop, which is the second one in the film. That's exactly what I thought. I was like, oh, this is his like writing playlist.
Right.
This is his like getting juiced up, you know?
Yeah. He gotta tap into that, you know, the whole New York thing, you know?
Yeah. Let the magic flow. yeah.
That was very odd. I don't know if maybe it sort of reminded me, did you ever see The Creator that came out?
Like a year ago?
Yeah. Last fall.
Yeah, yeah. I put it on like whatever streaming thing and fell asleep. This is basically how I watch all movies. I think like we've talked about 12 movies and I've only seen one of them, which is Civil War, and the rest I just fell asleep while watching on Hulu.
Well, that's the magic of the theatrical experience. But I mentioned Creator. Did you watch it long enough to hear the Radiohead needle drop for there's like this aerial invasion? This kind of Vietnam style invasion, and they're playing, I forget, something from Kid A or something.
I'm trying to remember. Maybe I may half remember, because I do feel like I saw something recently that had like a totally stupid Radiohead. So it must have been that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was bizarre. I mean, I kind of admired it somehow that they were trying, but yeah, for this film, yeah, I did not get it.
Yeah. But yeah, like I was tweeting, I'm glad like Martin Rev from Suicide is getting the A24 paycheck.
Oh yeah, there was another movie, wasn't there?
Oh yeah, someone else mentioned, yeah, I've seen two movies. I also saw Love Lies Bleeding.
That's it.
That's the other movie I've seen.
Where it works. I mean, there it works, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Although I will say the I think the choices are a little bit like Spotify era, like 80s kind of,
yeah,
new wave, no wave, cold wave kind of stuff that I'm like, in this milieu with these particular characters, like they would not have been listening to this music. Like, you know, one there's like a artist, Gina X Performance, that her song is used really prominently kind of early on in the film, and I'm like, like no one was listening. Like this wasn't like popular music.
Right.
And yeah, it's not like these are like cool New York kids, you know, like going to the, I don't know, Pyramid Club or whatever. It's like they're in Texas or wherever that movie was set. But it's fine. You know, it's fine. It's the movies. I love how I'm like giving Civil War a pass for being like, yeah, I don't know, it's just the president. Like, who cares? And then with like Love Lies Bleeding, I'm like, I don't know, man. Technically, this record wasn't released until the 90s when it was rediscovered. But that was a good film.
Well, I don't know what else to say about Civil War. We'll have to.
Well, I hope it doesn't happen.
I hope it doesn't happen. Yeah, we do
if
not
it
want
it. If it does, I hope it only affects my enemies and not myself or anyone I love or care about. I hope it does not shut down the repertory cinemas or listing websites.
I was going to say that. I hope that the screenings continue throughout the various bombardments.
Yeah. But then again, I feel like people would sort of try to like cancel people for like going to the movies, you know, like instead of... okay, never mind.
Well, I recently watched a documentary about U2 giving a concert in Sarajevo.
Yeah, that's the kind of activism we need.
And while Sarajevo was, you know, being besieged, there were underground clubs, music clubs. So the documentary actually talks a lot about them. So perhaps the same would happen if and when New York is under siege by the California-Texas alliance.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, again, also too, not to, I mean, I know we're like wrapping up, but like the scene with Jesse Plemons asking like, where are you from? I was like, how does this jive with, I was like, what is, but again, that scene was so disturbing and tense that it still works for me, even though, again, I think to me, like, I guess my takeaway from the movie is like, it's pretty dumb. It doesn't make sense. And yet somehow I kind of dug it. That's my capsule review.
I mean, I completely get that. I mean, I definitely have movies, plenty of movies like that. So, I mean, yeah, for that scene, I think it did work, but it worked in like this movie like suspense way. And that's what kind of, you know what I mean? It's like, this works on like the action face-off tension, who's going to get shot. But
But I also think it's like Jesse Plemons's performance, and also even the, like, you know, sunglasses he's wearing and stuff, which again, it's another thing about the film that's totally confusing, but it adds to the sort of, I guess you could say, like, wild cardness of that scene, which is what makes it so scary, because you don't know kind of like what, like, you don't know who he is or what he wants or how he's reacting. Is he reacting on any kind of rational way? It's just, he's just like a scary dude. And like the fact that you don't, I don't know. I found that scene so disturbing. And I think a lot of it's like, because his performance is, it's a little like funny and intimidating. And I don't know. It's a very good, like, short villainous turn. Perhaps he could pull a Ned Beatty and win an Oscar for his 4-minute scene.
It was pretty creepy. I mean, yeah. I'll give him that, because of or in spite of the pink shades.
But like, you don't think a guy in pink shades is gonna shoot you?
No, you do not. You not even that he would be able to draw a bead on you through the pink shades.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like I would be remiss if we didn't talk a bit, at least a bit, one or two other movies that we've seen.
I'm trying to think.
One movie I will mention just to get something out of having sat through it, because I didn't really like it that much. Roadhouse.
Oh yeah. I wasn't. Yeah.
But the only reason I want to mention is because what you were saying before about like the video gameness of Civil War was something I sort of actively felt with Roadhouse, and I maybe it was even more on purpose in Roadhouse, where like when he would have fights, especially in like the bar, I felt like the camera height and like the way you were kind of moving with him as he's like swinging punches felt very much like I was like piloting, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have expressed kind of dissatisfaction with that aspect of it. I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons that movie isn't all that great. It is kind of funny that Jake Gyllenhaal, it seems like he's really, really putting himself into this, like, direct to Amazon remake of Roadhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we don't have to dwell on it. I don't know if there's really that much to say about the movie, although it did also feel kind of depopulated to me, because then you just flick on like this Swayze one and it just, they were just instantly alive in a way that the new one's not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always flicking on the Swayze one.
That's just the soundtrack. You turn it on in the morning, get revved.
That's
up.
That's my Criterion 24/7.
Oh, yeah.
House on repeat.
Good to mention that. I don't know what to make of that. It's kind of interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of weird. I mean, I guess it's like Turner Classic Movies without any context.
Right.
But people seem to like it, at least. But then again, it's like maybe I just follow the, you know, the 1,000 people I follow or the 1,000 people who, yeah. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I like the kind of implicit idea, which is that you'll get pulled in just by like the images you're watching, just by the characters or whatever you're watching. So it's not someone like handing you this great director you should watch. It's really just you watch 20 seconds of it, and if it looks cool, maybe you keep watching, and that's how you're drawn. So I kind of like, there's some sort of purity to that feels nice.
I mean, I'm definitely about like linear viewing and curation and but I think what I like is being able to like check the schedule too, like classic movies and getting hyped. But I don't think they have a schedule, right?
Like, no, I feel like they're testing that out. They're going to see how annoyed people get and how many people like it. And then from there to decide. I mean, you can figure it out, and that you can add it to your list, and then that you'll see what movie is playing. I guess that's one way you could do it.
Okay. They should have John Derringer introduce the film.
I think that would be good. I'll put that in the suggestion box.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, what else have I seen? I mean, I saw the Radu Jude film, which I'm sure you've talked about a bunch.
Oh yeah, I did. Oh, but did you see Angela Goes On, the movie that is in the movie?
No.
Because they showed that, I went and saw it. They showed it as part of the Making Waves, the annual Romanian film series.
Oh, wow.
I think it was their opening night film 2 weeks ago. And it's pretty good. I mean, it's like definitely like an artifact, but it was really interesting to watch it.
Yeah. I haven't seen The Beast. I haven't seen...
Did you see Sperm World?
No, and I feel bad. I need to. Literally, like the director is like personally texting me, being like, "Hey, watch my movie Sperm World." And I'm like, "Okay."
Well, I
And I
couldn't
just
watch it until it was on something I couldn't watch, and then it was on something it was on, now it's on Hulu, I think. I'm
Yeah.
not sure.
I did watch the Nickelodeon pedophilia documentary.
I can't watch that. It's really disturbing to me, but I need to know about it. I really do.
Wait, did you? So wait, did you see it?
No, I haven't
Oh,
seen it.
okay, yeah.
I did watch the entirety of the MJ, the two-part MJ documentary that was like 5 years ago, and after that, I don't know that I can watch
Yeah.
this one. That one is good. It's definitely good. It's just like hard to watch.
Yeah. I mean, looking at my letterbox to see what other films I've watched recently, but I don't really update it. So this is the
Oh.
last movie I watched was in February.
Okay.
And it was the 1988 film Pin by Sandor Stern about it's sort of like Teorema, but with like a medical dummy instead of Terrence Stamp is how
Oh
I would
wow.
describe it.
That sounds good.
But anyway, so we're talking about
Stop.
pedophilia.
On television sets.
Yeah, I didn't even like this came out of nowhere. Someone was just like, I think my girlfriend was like, "Oh, there's like a Nickelodeon pedophilia documentary that premieres tonight." And I was like, "Cancel our
You're
plans."
like date night.
Yeah, I think literally it was like a two-part thing, and like the second night we did have like kind of like a couples date, and then I was like, "Babe, we got to get home and watch part two." But anyway, yeah, no, I mean it's really harrowing. I mean, it was like two parts, and you had to watch two nights in a row. It's a little interesting to me because a lot of it happens kind of just I'm like just old enough that I'm a little too old for kind of the era that it is. But it like basically this guy who's kind of like the golden boy at Nickelodeon who, you know, was discovering their biggest talent and writing their biggest shows, et cetera, was basically, you know, ultimately, I guess you would just say like he was like a really big creep. And I think the film does kind of leave questions open around the extent to which he was a creep, but certainly there's evidence just on screen, like when you watch clips of these episodes, particularly around stuff like children's feet and stuff like that, it's really disturbing. It's just wrong.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like public, and a lot of people knew about that. But the other thing is that one of his sort of right-hand guys was convicted of sexual assault on a minor. And that minor was like a John Doe. Like no one knew sort of who it was. Like, you know, it could have been like a random neighbor or something. And the, you know, kind of thing that's revealed is that the John Doe was Drake Bell, who was like a huge Nickelodeon star. So some of the earlier stuff they did, like all that was like kind of my era, but like Drake Bell, that was after I was like definitely too old. That's when I was doing drugs and dreaming of creating Screen Slate. I mean, but it really exposes the just it feels like such a cliche to say, but just how I feel like Hollywood is just not safe for children. And even the thing that's a little again, this is a documentary, so which is to say choices have been made and you know certain people they kind of shape their narratives and stuff in the editing obviously. This is documentary 101 for Last Thing I Saw, listeners. But you know, like Drake Bell's dad seems like he was kind of like trying to like stay aware and be involved and like make good choices. And the way they kind of isolated Drake from his father is very scary because it kind of goes to show like, even if you are a parent who's trying to sort of be mindful and make good decisions, they were kind of like manipulating, you know, because when you're a kid at that age too, like you start to rebel against your parents. And if someone's like, you know, "Your dad sucks, come hang out in my weird, creepy house," it's like, yeah. I don't, that's an oversimplification. And then, you know, I guess like as a film, I think it's a little sloppy and then it kind of goes back to the original guy. And, but it's like after you hear about the Drake Bell stuff, it's so horrifying that it's very like extreme, like what went on. So I think structurally it's a little strange and feels a little unfocused. But it's something that's always kind of fascinated me, particularly, you know, with obviously like the Corys and other stuff. It's just, it seems like Hollywood has never been safe for children and probably never will be. And, you know, part of me always kind of wonders if it's like ethical for children to be in movies. But then I'm like, then what's the alternative? AI children?
Yeah, I wonder if that's going to happen. I mean,
AI animated children.
Well, if they're going about replacing other, you know, actors, I wonder if that's where they'll. But it is this weird kind of exception where we don't accept child labor, except when they're acting, I guess, or performing. But I feel like I should watch it. It's also same for me. Not, I don't think it's quite the era. I always felt like I was kind of watching reruns when I was watching Nickelodeon, so I never really knew when anything was coming from. Like, I remember watching You Can't Do That on Television, but they always felt like they were from 5 years earlier already.
They get a little into like Amanda Bynes. I feel
that's
like
that's after. I didn't. I don't know.
With Amanda Bynes era. Yeah. I remember when I first moved here, I used to see her around the East Village. Like, I would go out partying with my NYU roommates. I did not go to NYU. I was merely the like creepy 22-year-old who lived with like, you know, 21-year-old NYU students. But yeah, you know, we would go to Welcome to the Johnsons, little bar called Welcome to the Johnsons on, it's across from where like the Magician is now. Like,
okay.
Cause now it's in like Bushwick or something. But I remember like I used to like see her around there a lot. And then one time I went to get Dollar Pizza with my friend Amy, and Amanda Bynes sat next to us and kept telling Amy she really liked her handbag, which was cool.
Wow.
It's like, wow, I'm talking to Amanda Bynes.
Celebrity sighting.
Also, Justin Long, I remember seeing maybe that same night. I'm name dropping all my, he kind of disappeared. But yeah, I mean, this was circa like 2009. So oh, okay. I mean, that would be like seeing.
Prime long time.
That would be like seeing, I don't know, who's in movies? I don't watch movies, so I don't know. Me click Letterboxd, see the most popular films. That would be like seeing, what are these movies? I'm just looking at like popular with your friends on Letterboxd. It's like Monkey Man.
That's the Dev Patel. What are you talking about? That's like, the way you said that, it really is clear you had not seen that title.
Oh yeah, I guess it was kind of like seeing Timothy Chalamet, you know, when you would see Justin Long in 2009. People don't realize that Long was the Chalamet of his time.
Yes, it's whatever happened. We hardly knew ye.
Yeah,
yeah. I did watch the Larry Fessenden film Blackout.
Oh, how's that? I mean, I haven't really kept up with modern Fessenden.
No, I haven't either. It's a werewolf movie, basically. Mm-hmm. Extensively filmed in the Catskills, so it has a very lovely backdrop. It's played by this actor who I only learned through the inclusion of photos in the film. He plays an artist who is kind of undermined in his enjoyment of life by the fact that he periodically kills people as a werewolf. But he also has like this anxiety or like the looming shadow of his father, who's like a business, like a shifty business owner and big shot. Mm. And that actor who plays that character is the son of the late William Hurt.
Oh, whoa.
And the way I learned that is because, you know, in movies, they're like, they show a photo of the actor as the character as a kid or something with some dad figure. And sometimes you're like, oh, that really is a photo of the actor as a kid because you recognize them. In this case, just sitting in the photo with him is William Hurt. And it's so weird because obviously it's not mentioned because within the film, he's not William Hurt. He's this character's father. But that was an interesting thing in the film.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, I'm like processing what you're saying now. Yeah, it's like, it's just like, here's me as a kid and like just William Hurt.
Yeah. but I don't know if that was part of the appeal of the story, just because the character in the movie is overshadowed by his father. And I don't know if that's the case for the actor, but
there are layers.
I mean, the last thing I'd say about Blackout is I just think Larry Fessenden, he like, there's always something like a little artful and kind of handcrafted about when he's like visualizing something you think you've seen 100 times before. And I think that's also the case in a couple of things in this movie, the way they use the characters' paintings and, I don't know, the moon, I don't know, stuff you think you're completely familiar with. I don't know.
Cool. I guess speaking of the last truly cinematic event that I saw.
Yes.
The eclipse.
Oh, yeah. How about it?
I went to Cleveland to watch it, which is like
cool.
Basically where I'm from, and my brother lives in Cleveland.
Was it a full one there, or total, whatever it's called?
Yeah, so we were directly in the path of totality.
Okay.
And yeah, it was cool. And I was trying to explain to like my brother, who's like never seen a movie, how the eclipse was like expanded cinema.
Oh wow.
And I don't think he totally understood, but
having not the original like reference point of cinema.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm literally like, I feel like I asked him, I was like, have you like, what's like the last movie you saw? I feel like he was like Toy Story 2 or something. I don't know. Yeah, these apples fell on like separate parts of the tree. Actually, my parents too. They're, well, you know what's crazy is like my parents never went to movies before the pandemic. And somehow they've become like post-pandemic film goers.
Oh, wow.
And my mom was recommending a film to me called Argyle. I don't know if you're familiar with this film, Argyle, from the director of The Kingsman.
I've heard of it.
I was like, that's kind of crazy. Like my mom, like I feel like for most people, like they stopped going to movies. Like,
right.
After the pandemic, whereas my parents are like literally going to see like everything, including Argyle.
That's so great. I don't know. That's,
yeah.
This is the counterexample. They got to get quoted in a Variety article. They're like, it's different for us, actually, the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, they're out there, the Argyle fans. You know, it's just, the thing is like these East Coast critics, these coastal critics, actually.
That's right. It's a,
you know, they don't understand flyover country. And that's why I think that's the value of Screen Slate, is that, you know, so many of us are from Ohio, and we can speak to the heart of America in our repertory film coverage.
Yes.
Of New York City and the San Francisco Bay.
Well, yeah, that's the eclipse. Did you do the pinhole thing? So you had like a image?
I had the glasses.
Oh, you had the glasses. Okay.
Yeah. And then the thing is, like right before, you know how you can kind of see a sliver and you have to have the glasses on because it's too bright, and then it like gradually disappears.
Yeah.
Like these people next to me started playing Dark Side of the Moon, like right when totality was about to happen. And I got really mad, and for some reason my reaction to that was to like stare at the sun without my glasses.
No.
And so then when I put them back on, all I could see was like a big green splotch. And so I missed like the moment that the like sliver disappeared, and then I took off my glasses and still had, I mean, even now that I'm saying it, I'm like, maybe I still have green splotch. I don't know. But and so I did kind of miss it. But then totality there lasted for like 4.5 minutes. So it was cool, like super silvery. That's what I didn't realize was like, I mean, it's just, you see this like insane silver ring in the sky. And I was just, and it wasn't completely dark. Like that's what I think I was a little surprised about. I thought for some reason it was supposed to get like pitch black, but instead it just kind of made, we were on this big hill too, with like a 360 degree, like really amazing view. And it just almost looked like there was like this ring of fire around the horizon and then like a silver ring in the sky.
Oh, wow.
It was very cool. I would give it 4.5 letterboxed stars.
That struck me too. I thought it was going to get darker than it did. But it was kind of cinematic. Did you have the thing where, because it got dim, but there was also like a breeze. It was like in the movies when like something bad's going to happen.
Whoa, yeah.
It was a cool breeze.
Wait, were you in New York or did you had to path of totality?
I did partial deluxe totality package.
Okay.
In New York, yeah, just in a field and a park.
Yeah. Speaking of, actually, a good rec for last thing I saw, viewers, is a video called Path of Totality by the artist Frank Heath.
Ooh.
Where he visits like a field in I think in Missouri maybe, which is around where he's from, and like it's basically it's kind of like heavy metal parking lot, but even more deadpan and understated, for like Eclipse viewing, and I think it was 2017.
Cool.
And I think it's on his Vimeo, like publicly.
Oh, nice.
But it's like maybe 20 minutes long, and I would very highly recommend it. Little esoteric art film video art recommendation for everyone.
I like it. Well, that's I think that's a good point. We can end with recommendation for anyone who missed the eclipse.
Yeah. And even though the politics of the eclipse were not totally clear to me, I still found it to be an engaging paracinematic experience.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was a little, I'll be honest, I was a little bothered by the liberal agenda of the eclipse.
Yeah.
You know, it was sort of blatant. But I was yeah, able to overcome that. And
well, people kept wanting to like take off work to watch it.
There you go.
It's like, I'm sorry, but you know, the rest of the world is not stopping. these repertory film blog listings aren't going to add themselves. That's what I said to my many employees. well, I went to the beautiful state of Ohio.
Well, we'll end with the mighty eclipse, nature cinema.
That's right.
John, thank you. I feel like I kind of kidnapped you for 2 hours, but
no, it's cool, man. I was probably gonna take a nap or game, okay. So you know, this really worked out.
Okay.
And you know, I've successfully done no work today. I woke up, I saw a movie I can't talk about, and then I went and saw Civil War at noon, and then ate a can of tuna, and
since then I've been podcasting
and have just been potting ever since.
All right, well, I'll work to get this while the ink is still wet to get it out.
Cool. Yeah, let's drop these takes.
I'm sure people will be sick of it like tomorrow.
I know. Yeah, well, you know, as I tweeted, you know, no one is talking about Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead 24 remake.
It's true. I am seeing that soon after I record.
Like, actually, for real?
Yeah, no, I wasn't kidding. I want to, full disclosure, we have a poster of the original Don't Tell Mom on our wall.
Really? Wow. Oh, yes. Okay.
My partner, it is my wife's poster. I cannot take credit for it. But yeah.
Yeah.
So
I'm looking at the cast, and someone in it is just named Ms. Pat.
See?
Like, who is that? Ms. Pat?
Also, June Squibb. June Squibb plays an evil grandma or something. It plays the evil babysitter, I guess.
Nicole Richie? What? Okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
Well, we're going tomorrow, so.
Squibb and Richie? And Ms. Pat? All right.
All right. We'll sign off there.
All right. Thanks, Nick.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.